why are we doing this exploratory drilling when we don't have hardly any infrastructure up in this remote and harsh area?
Alaskans make the case against Arctic Ocean drilling to congressional staffers. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, January 25th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a report looks at the impact of expanding Medicaid on the state economy.
This is an opportunity that we believe would be too good to pass up.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2013 PFD and consider sharing a portion of your dividend through Pick, Click, Give or contributing to a college savings plan. More information at pfd.alaska.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Environmentalists from Alaska are hoping to persuade congressional staffers that Shell Oil should not continue its drilling operation in the Arctic this summer. As APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the groups held a congressional briefing this morning.
Congressional briefings are free of the formalities and TV cameras of congressional hearings, and they lack the members of Congress themselves. And many in this town think that's a good thing, because it's the staffers who attend the briefings, and it's the staffers who have the policy expertise. The briefing was organized by the office of California Democrat Barbara Boxer. She chairs the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. Werner Wilson traveled from Anchorage to tell the room about how important fishing is to his native Bristol Bay.
I know that the oil is declining up in the North Slope, but at the same time, you know, I come from a region where we depend on our wildlife, we depend on the ocean for our livelihood. It's been our livelihood, our people's livelihood, for thousands of years.
Wilson, who dons a spotted seal fur vest and necktie, works for the World Wildlife Fund. He says he's not opposed to drilling in the future, but the company and government need to ensure the infrastructure will be put in place first.
What's the rush? Why are we doing this exploratory drilling when we don't have hardly any infrastructure up in this remote and harsh area?
That's a sentiment echoed by Kylie Crow. She works for the D.C.-based Center for American Progress, or CAP, a left-leaning think tank that has a lot of sway with Democrats in Washington.
Our initial stance was that we were open to the possibility of Arctic offshore drilling if companies could prove that they were fully prepared.
Last week, CAP rescinded its support. Crow says Shell proved it was unable to move forward just yet. She says CAP may come around to support Arctic drilling. The ongoing 60-day study at the Department of Interior will provide some guidance. Crow says the expedited review will need to address Shell's shortcomings.
In terms of infrastructure, in terms of response preparedness, in terms of scientific knowledge of the region. If those things are met, then, there is a potential that we could be open to it.
Shell Alaska's spokesperson was not available for an interview. In an email, Curtis Smith says the company is still assessing the Kulik's condition and how its grounding will affect future exploration in Alaska. He says the company is committed to operating safely off Alaska's shores. Michael Levine is Pacific Senior Counsel at Oceana. He's in D.C. from Juneau and is meeting with Department of Interior officials to discuss the ongoing review. He says Interior never changed any criteria determining which sites are suitable for offshore drilling after the Deepwater Horizon spill in the Gulf of Mexico.
The Department of the Interior granted these approvals, defended them publicly and in court, and has stated its commitment to exploration in the Arctic. We need a review that goes beyond those commitments and those defenses, and it's our hope that Congress may play a role in making that happen.
Congress has yet to do anything. Senator Mark Begich has said he'll hold hearings on the grounding, but no dates or witnesses have been announced. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
A new report shows Alaska would see a big economic boost if the state decides to accept federal dollars to expand the Medicaid program. But Governor Parnell has expressed serious reservations about that expansion. APRN's Annie Feit reports.
The study from Northern Economics was commissioned by the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. It shows that every dollar the state spends on expanding Medicaid would generate $15 from the federal government. It estimates 4,000 new jobs would be created by 2017. Andy Tuber is president of ANTHC. He thinks the report makes the case in favor of the Medicaid expansion.
I think that we join with our partners in healthcare across the state in conveying that this is an opportunity that we believe would be too good to pass up.
The Affordable Care Act allows states to offer Medicaid coverage to more residents starting in 2014. The federal government will cover 100% of the cost of the expansion for the first 3 years and gradually transition to 90% by 2020. But states can opt out of the expansion. 10 states with Republican governors have already done that. Governor Parnell hasn't yet decided. Tuber says increasing the number of Alaskans eligible for Medicaid would have a big impact on the population the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium serves. He says the expansion would allow an estimated 17,000 Alaska Natives in the state to get Medicaid coverage.
Most of those individuals are already being served, but they're uninsured, and so they're drawing on very constrained and limited resources within the system in order to provide that service. So this would certainly allow us to create a more robust and accessible healthcare model, not just here in the urban centers, but across rural Alaska.
The Parnell administration has commissioned its own study on the impact of the Medicaid expansion. It's in draft form, but hasn't been released yet. Even before he's seen the report, though, Parnell is raising serious concerns about expanding Medicaid. He says it may sound like a good thing, with the federal government picking up so much of the tab, but he worries the government will reduce the generous matching amount.
My concern is that we would accept expanded costs in a larger program at a time when the federal government doesn't even know whether it can meet the existing obligations it has. That's something that is in the forefront of my mind as oil production continues to decline, as our state revenues decline with that declining production and declining price.
Early this month, Arizona Republican Governor Jan Brewer announced a solution to the problem Parnell raises. She wants to accept the Medicaid expansion, but include what she calls a circuit breaker that would reduce enrollment if the federal government decreased reimbursement rates. In the past, Brewer has been an outspoken critic of the health care law. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Governor Parnell has appointed Judge Joel Bolger to the Alaska Supreme Court. He currently serves on the Alaska Court of Appeals. He will replace Justice Walter Bud Carpinetti, who announced his retirement last year. According to the governor's office, Judge Bolger first moved to Alaska in 1978. He has served on the Court of Appeals in Anchorage since 2008. Tlingit and Haida dancers welcomed astronaut Buzz Aldrin to the UAA's Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, or ANSEP, today. Aldrin, who was part of the Apollo 11 mission to the moon in 1969, was the second man to leave his footprints on the lunar surface after mission commander Neil Armstrong. Aldrin, now 83 years old, has a message for young people today.
Determination, effort, and approach. You got to have a plan. You got to have determination, and you got to apply a big effort to get that plan, the approach, underway.
Aldrin says at the end of the Apollo program, the U.S. was a leader in math, science, and engineering, but that is not the case today.
We've actually labeled them some STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. But that's for geeks, okay? We need to get other people in, so we now are calling it STEAM power. Science, technology, engineering, arts, and math. And indeed, we have an education system that doesn't seem to be working all that well.
Aldrin says although NASA has ended the space shuttle program, future efforts are likely to focus on Mars exploration. He says he'd like to see the country commit to building a permanent base on Mars. Aldrin is the keynote speaker at tonight's ANSEP celebration in Anchorage. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, restoring an old cabin on the Kenai Peninsula.
I found a newspaper clipping. It was folded up, and it was from 1890 from the San Francisco Examiner.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, supporting the Clare House Replacement Project. There's more information online at cssalaska.org. The Kinnick Arm Crossing will connect Anchorage to the Matsu Valley. The bridge is intended to create construction jobs, provide access to land for commercial, industrial, and residential development, and save freight costs for Alaska's interior and North Slope. More information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
Haines police are following up on hundreds of tips after two dogs from the community were shot with arrows. One died. The shootings occurred January 15th when Shannon Thompson let her dogs out of her Haines home like she does every morning. A short time later, Maple, a rat terrier, returned with an arrow stuck in her head. She recovered from her wound with vet treatment, but Thompson's other dog, Roxy, didn't come home for another day.
She got home and crawled up on the couch and I didn't know that she had, you know, an arrow in her. I was just like, God, what is that sticking out of her back? Because it was all the way in. I mean, it was all under the skin.
The arrow was lodged through most of Roxy's body. She was also flown to Juneau but died while vets operated on her. The case immediately drew attention in the community. Haines Police Chief Gary Lowe says the arrows have been sent to the state crime lab to try to recover forensic evidence from them. The police are also offering an award for information in the case. With additional donations, the fund has reached more than $750. Earlier this month, the Alaska Board of Game refused to lift a six-year moratorium on proposals regarding wolves in the Denali region. The moratorium was put in place after the board canceled a trapping and hunting buffer zone on the eastern border of the park in 2010. As KYC's Emily Schwing reports, it's the latest in an ongoing battle between the state, environmental groups, and the federal government on how best to manage wolves in Denali National Park.
In 1992, the Alaska Board of Game approved a five-year moratorium on moose hunting in the lower Yukon region. They approved a similar moratorium in the lower Kuskokwim region in 2003. Board of Game Chairman Ted Spraker says the board's decision not to consider any proposals regarding Denali area wolves until 2016 is in line with their management responsibilities.
We're allowed to set these moratoriums in place. Mainly it's just to give something a little bit of time to work itself through.
Last summer, the National Park Service counted 57 wolves in 9 wolf packs inside Denali National Park and Preserve. It's a 61% decline since 2007. That's when the population peaked at 147 wolves. Spraker doesn't believe lifting the moratorium addresses what's really happening to Denali's wolf population.
It's the lack of food.
He says the prey population within the park isn't high enough to sustain the wolves.
Wolves will maintain a territory as long as there's food available. And when the food becomes scarce, that's when they do these different things. That's when they start expanding territories. That's when packs break up.
Biologists believe at least one wolf pack that lives in the park dispersed last year. Last fall, the Board of Game denied 3 requests that would have halted trapping and hunting of wolves on state lands surrounding the park. Conservation biologist Rick Steiner says part of the problem is that the park boundary cuts right through the heart of winter habitat for caribou and the wolves that hunt them.
There's been research that was first done 40 years ago that showed that, this is a very natural winter migration for a number of these eastern Denali wolf packs. To cross this invisible boundary of the park and onto the state land.
Ted Spraker recognizes that a large prey population outside Denali is problematic, but he says there's not much the state can do.
Enhancing populations of prey outside of the park has been detrimental to wolves living inside of the park. But I can tell you right now, the department and the board is not going to quit doing that. because we have subsistence priorities and we have a lot of people in the state, you know, that depend on moose and caribou for food to fill their freezers.
National Park Service personnel were unavailable to comment on future plans to manage wolves inside Denali National Park and Preserve. However, they are looking at various options. The Board of Game meets in February in Wasilla. Rick Steiner has submitted a proposal to establish a new buffer zone that protects Denali wolves. He says this could be his last option.
I think there's a strong possibility of litigation.
With the moratorium still in place and no changes to the board, Ted Spraker says it's unlikely Steiner's latest proposal will garner enough support for consideration. I'm Emily Schwing in Fairbanks.
Fishing is off limits in the Arctic, but this summer, a pair of commercial trawlers traveled north to the Chukchi Sea. They were on a scientific mission to conduct the first ever comprehensive study of the Chukchi's ecosystem. At the Alaska Marine Science Symposium in Anchorage this week, KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal got a sneak peek at some of the sea life they found and how it will help track the effects of climate change.
After combing the Chukchi and Northern Bering seafloor for 2 months straight, Franz Muench's team came back with heaps of samples.
We found about 66 fish species and over 350 invertebrate species in the bottom trawl survey.
Muench is a University of Alaska Fairbanks fisheries professor. He's leading the trawl study in American Arctic waters, and his goal is to gather a baseline data set for marine life in the area before climate change and oil and gas development alter the ecosystem. While some parts of the Chukchi seafloor have been studied before, mostly around oil and gas lease sites, Muirter's survey is much more comprehensive. The two vessels covered a 30-mile grid, weaving back and forth to capture sea life living on the surface, in the middle of the water column, and on the ocean bottom. They found plenty of flatfish and Arctic cod, plus a large colony of snow crab in the Chukchi. But not all of the creatures they pulled up were so easily recognizable.
NOAA had never done a survey in that area, or at least not in many years, and they didn't have species codes for a lot of the species in their database.
But even though some of the animals haven't turned up for a long time, Murata says he doubts they're new species.
But I suspect that most of them have probably been seen before.
Murata's team is planning another field trip in the Chukchi this summer to retrawl the surface in midwater with a smaller net, in hopes of collecting smaller species they might have missed in 2012. In the meantime, they're sharing their big-picture data with other scientists working on more focused projects. Muirter himself is interested in taking a closer look at Arctic cod as an indicator of climate change. The trawl survey showed that Arctic cod fills a role in the Chukchi, like pollock does in the Bering Sea. It's a plentiful food source for seabirds and mammals in the area, and as the climate changes, it'll be on the move.
We know it's responsive to temperature variabilities, so the southern extent of the species shifts a lot with temperature. As the temperature cools, it expands further south, and as the temperature warms up, it retreats into the colder portions of the Arctic.
While the Arctic cod is a good indicator of what the climate's doing, the fact that the climate is changing is also a problem for these researchers. The baseline that they're trying to establish might be more of a moving target. Still, the data will have practical uses in the short term. Muirter's team thinks the government can use it to determine the environmental impacts of offshore oil and gas leases. It's also going to come in handy for resource managers, who are trying to figure out whether it's safe to open parts of the Arctic to commercial fisheries, and not just fishing boats, moonlighting as research vessels. In Anchorage, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059. And by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugia,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Aleknarechamute.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Sophie Ivan. This week on AK, restoration. For the past 3 years, a small group of dedicated volunteers has been putting in countless hours restoring a watchman's cabin for the Kasilof Regional Historical Association. Each Friday, they get together and make a few small steps toward bringing the once ailing cabin back to life. KDLL's Shailen Cochran has the story.
I'd heard about this group from a friend of mine who suggested we stop by some Friday when the group gets together at the cabin's new home near the McLean Center in Kisilov. When we arrived, Bill Nelson and Bud Crawford, two of the regulars, were at work cutting lumber and contemplating the next step for the main room in the watchman's cabin, but Bud was eager to give us a quick tour.
Now, we don't know when this was necessarily all put together and everything, but right over in the corner, there was a nail, a big spike. And in that spike, I found a newspaper clipping. It was folded up, and it was from 1890, February 17th, 1890, from the newspaper in San Francisco, the San Francisco Examiner. And we still have it inside the cabin there, inside the McLean Center.
That newspaper clipping is one of few clues that remain to help Crawford, Nelson, and the rest recreate an early 20th century Alaskan cabin. What we do know is that the cabin was originally home to the supervisor of what was then just the second commercial salmon cannery in the state. Long before the Kenai Peninsula was settled, that cannery and the cabin that housed its boss represented a big change for the Dena'ina population who lived here, says Kenai Peninsula College anthropology professor Dr. Alan Boris.
So it represents what I have called the coming of the Industrial Revolution to the north. So mostly railroad money developed these canneries and really transformed the area from a subsistence fishing type area to a commercial fishing enterprise. And for the Dena'ina, it meant jobs, but it also meant a change in the social order. The Dena'ina became second-class citizens in their own homeland.
With two levels, seven rooms, and more than 1,000 square feet, the cabin was rather palatial in its day compared to other early cabins, but decades of neglect and abuse have left it in a pretty sad state. The old cannery tins used to roof the building are loose and rusty, and work on the interior is just beginning.
And put together, so, and even the ceiling will be wallpaper. That's how they did it, so we have to do it. And we saved a piece of the wallpaper over here.
The group suffered a setback on December 7th when one of the regular Friday crew, Mike Wiley, died.
And it's been Gary Titus, Bill Nelson, myself, Bud Crawford, and a gentleman that just passed away, Mike Wiley. We're down to three. And each of us kind of had our specialty. Mike was a good tree getter. He always got good trees for us. We were working on his logs, and so that was really kind of fun to have him get those logs for us. But luckily we're finished with the logs, and now we're just trying to get the thing back into the shape it was back in the 20s, 1910 to 1930, something like that.
But the logs Mike left behind needed some attention. My friend who brought me out here, Brandon, was just as interested in the history of the cabin as me, but he was really after getting a feel for some of the period tools and techniques the guys are using in the restoration. And Bud and Bill were more than happy to accommodate by giving us some logs to peel.
I'll be back in an hour.
Okay. That's
hey,
fun.
I like a guy that works for 100 years of drawing on himself.
We'll take turns.
Yeah, there you go.
I like it.
It's not bad, is it?
I really like it. That's
a lot. It gets you in the shoulders, but that's how you got to do it.
Am I doing too much?
No.
Too little?
Perfect. These are the marks you want.
Really a lot easier than me. Just kind of let it do its own cutting.
We were pretty proud of ourselves. We had that log peeled in way under an hour, and I think it was good enough work that we'll be invited back to help build some more and learn some more about this piece of the peninsula's history. There's still plenty of work left, putting up a stairway to the loft, and Bud is still mastering the custom Bohemian dovetail joints that hold the whole cabin together. He says there is no shortage of projects to keep people busy. Other cabins are awaiting restoration, and a boat project could be in the works. Maybe for that one I'll learn about gunwales and thwarts. Reporting from Kisilov, I'm Shaylin Cochran.
You got that done yet? We got four more to do.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're going to Yakutat in northern southeast Alaska.
Yeah, this is Les Hartley, and I've been here in Yakutat working as an aircraft pilot and mechanic since 1995. It's a small community of commercial fishermen There's sport fishing lodges, big game guides, and it's just about around 500 to 600 people. The Yakutat forelands are very flat from the ocean up to the mountains, but the mountains are the highest coastal mountain range in the world. They go literally from sea level to 18,000 to 19,000 feet. We also have very harsh harsh weather here, coastal storms with high winds and a lot of rain. I've been told we get between 120 to 140 inches of precip annual. The surfing is really good, but you have to wear a wetsuit. It's cold water, and people do come from all over the world to surf here. There's even a surf shop here. The economy is not faring well right now due to the high cost of living. And with the outside economy, there's less tourism, fewer people coming in to go sport fishing. When the weather's nice, it's one of the most beautiful places in the world. The mountains here are absolutely gorgeous. It's a great place to come and fish. It's not your tourist Alaska. It's real Alaska.
Les Hartley is a pilot who lives in Yakutat. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Shailen Cochran, Annie Fite, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Sophie Evan.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer and Lauren Rosenthal in Anchorage, Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, and Emily Schwing in Fairbanks. Sophie Evan was our AK guest host this week. APRN's Peter Granitz reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Fite. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
the 2013 statewide BP Teachers of Excellence program. Teacher nomination forms are available at bpteachers.com. The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority was created by the Alaska State Legislature to develop, stimulate, and advance the economic welfare of the state and further the development of public transportation systems. The authority has completed required environmental work to date, and the Federal Highway Administration has given its approval needed to move forward. There's more information at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. Parents, be a hero to your kids. Make time to be physically active as a family. Encourage your children to participate in the Alaska Healthy Futures Challenge at their school. All kids need to do is be active 3 times a week and keep a log of their physical activities. They'll feel great and get cool prizes, too. Go to playeveryday.alaska.gov to find out if your child's elementary school is participating in the Healthy Futures Challenge. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.